Okay, welcome. This is my third dialogue with Riff Router. It is January 18th, 2012, and we're starting at 4:14 p.m. Hawaii time. Greetings, Riff Router.
Bob, how are you?
Okay, so we're going to go into your document. Let's get into it.
So the background here is I'm going to be reading a text that was written. Actually, it's interesting because this text was written several years ago, and specifically around the effects with the kicking off of wars in the Fertile Crescent as well as in Afghanistan. So the title of the text is Nanowar, and the principal idea behind doing this was the fact that it was apparent to me based upon my own analysis of the environment and the situation of the unreal or the simulacra that was being pushed through, reflected through, reverberated through the media environments that we engage with, that there was a particular type of event was happening which I felt was diametrically opposed to what was being communicated acoustically. So in other words, the headlines being read, the narrative of what was happening, and then actually the actual motive or events as far as waveforms and information, how things were being parroted and communicated, and the patterns appearing were different. So the purpose of this text was to kind of elaborate on some of the thoughts that I had with respect to those events, notably the title of the text is Nanowar, and that actually title comes from the nature of war, which I feel has shifted tremendously, especially in light of the internet age or the information age or the post-information age. And so after reading the text, I'm specifically looking for feedback from you, Bob, because obviously I think that this is an important subject, an important discourse and dialogue to be had. So,
right, so read it clearly. Enunciate the words.
Right.
And it's
right.
About eight paragraphs or
right.
So, not too long.
So it goes a little something like this. Nanowar. War is the principal adjudicator and arbitrator of conscience in the domain of human affairs. It is the omniscient justice of historical consequence, the legislator of power, and the administrator of radical societal change. The forces of war dictate at a most mundane and fundamental level the implications of information and the emergence of technology. War is the parent of cultural progeny, and inasmuch as it pertains to the nature of conflict and confrontation, the temporality of war is implicated in a condition of diminishing latency. The images of war are infinitely mirroring the moment the activity is executed. There is no hiding the barbarism, the inhumanity, and the death. It is a spectacle extraneously appropriated to technical reflectors who inevitably broadcast vast destruction across the hemisphere. It is coterminal, it is resistant to slowness, and is a function of instantaneity. Instantaneity is a property referent to the autonomous immediate communication of image and sound across the terrestrial precipice of Earth. Information in the virtual real is an analog of quantum entanglement, traveling faster than the velocity of light. This instantaneity facilitates the exponential nonlinear propulsion of data inundating the stratosphere. It is a phenomenon both resultant as well as being endemic to computational ubiquity and network ambience. We are all constantly and inextricably linked. By circumstance, instantaneity is pan-directional and electronically vectorized. It is meshed with informatic content, twittering in nanosecond samples into the observant field of agency. It produces a new dimensionality of awareness, an occurrent stratagem to confrontation. Violence, the mastering and the skillful execution of it, becomes bitwise and hypermediated. Its methodology is superseded by the panoptical actuality of extended virtual reals, geographic and extraterrestrial dispersal, supercomputing, digital cryptography, mass media, and artificial intelligence. The framework of violence is embedded in information potentiality and the capitalization of parametrically encapsulated points of reference, dictating the terms of debate, sequestering voices of protest, hypermediating the marginalization of opposition, implanting and forcing a centralized conception of the real by engineering perception. This is the bit war. The taxonomy of images, sounds, and diction utilized by the class of institutions and individuals able to propel on command supranationally scalar violence is the language of Bitwar, and it is this content which defines this perception. The constant inundation of super-edited video clips purporting global events simultaneously multicasted across the transnational dynamic of identities and cultures fractures the historical ideology of war. Hypermediated conflicts espouse a duplicitous and sweeping aesthetic by mirroring a reel authored in laboratories and conference rooms, cultivated by advanced designers and digital arts professionals in the employ of the military bureaucratic directors. Constant twittering of events urbanize the temporality of experience and overpopulate the mental plane of consciousness with staged experiences reflected on the surfaces of matter as far as the biological retina can perceive. The war is a livid theatrical spectacle engaged in technicolor, emotional detail, as imbued and imprinted upon the astral lens of the human mind. It is a torrent of images symbolically defining the language of war, the configuration of polarities, and the relegation of force. The departure of concern transitions from an event horizon no longer allocated to the engagement matrix of military fields, but rather the thought plane of the uninitiated masses, inundating bitwise the neural machinery of the production, service class, and society, the illusion of impending disaster, the anxiety of insecurity, and the technological fission of ethics. The onslaught of apocalypse, Torture Core Cinema, and Rotten.com contextualized with Pastor Rick stigmatize the uninitiated towards a wretched conclusion of paranoid technigo, diffusing any level of individuation and self-awareness, furthering a consumption demography which makes possible even more advanced militarism, a gratuitous self-involved cyclical magnet. Fear creates consumption, ultimately compressing the field of engagement not in Afghanistan, Iraq, or West Africa, but the belief system embedded in the inner sphere of each person susceptible to and witness of the manufactured half-dimmed virtual dream. The question remains, however, because we arrive at a scenario where as two impending forces collide, the top-down model illustrated above and the bottom-up spectator model which we consider below. On the spectator side, the prevalence of personalized electronics gauges the impact of high-intensity, technologically advanced military engagement. The digital images presenting the ramifications of collateral damage is the theater of the macabre and the grotesque, severed heads and limbs of civilians eviscerated from cluster bombs, stillborn radiation children, lacerations to the body on the civilian population of Afghanistan and Iraq. These are well inculcated into the cognitive fabric of the Western mind, and it is an incredible break away from the formerly tightly controlled hierarchical narrative. The domestic machination of a populist perception of war directly confronts the reality made viral through the advent of global IP networks and rapidly proliferating JPEG and MPEG accessibility. Abu Ghraib is a stark example. The bombs falling on Gaza are seen in real time on the television screens of the suburbanite. Even the terror narrative becomes difficult to enforce by the appointed mouthpieces of war pigs, in spite of the video images mirrored ambiently. The psychological impact is stupefying because the split horizon of the real, inundating the mental countenance of the spectator, manifests cognitive paralysis of extreme proportions. The relegated state-controlled message diametrically opposes the images being seen. Who are the terrorists and who are the civilians? The destruction of reason coupled with grand-scale irrationalism is purely mad, beyond mad. Capitalism is the new socialism. With the omnipresent networks and computational ubiquity, war becomes a weaponization of images and sounds. It is an exercise in aesthetics, projecting the emotional life of the taxpayer into an architecture of state-approved visuality. Aestheticization of war, one that is an immoral, dark, destructive, and arbitrator of civilization. A super-aggression malleable at its worst toward an increasingly brutal human experience. Are we more civilized or are we civil? Lies. It is this specificity, this psychotronic execution of weaponized aesthetic, which has been covertly withheld from the public mind. The control of information has always been typically manipulated by the military-industrial complex in order to minimize exposure to the court of publicity, but now with the vectors of informationalization extenuating reach to every square picometer, every temporality, every iPhone, every spatial construct, infinite awareness becomes a function of processing capabilities and less a function of political or social class. It is this hypermediation of war, the images of war, which not only manifest a fracture in the language of war, but the very means by which war is engaged. War becomes less kinetic and more potential. The images of war become the weapons of war, weaponized as psychological progenitors of kinetic actuality. It is an operational capacitation of the imaginary future, capitalizing on the mediation of the opposition and their consequent exposure to the field of images documenting the possibilities. A cognitive battle, an engagement with abstracted technology, triggered completely on the ability for an aggressor to manipulate the neurological circuitry, wiring the fabric of the opposition's thinking, engendering mimetic resonance through the network of premeditated and tactically specific imagery. Instrumenting viral ideas and injecting them surgically into the social stratus of the opposition's culture. Engagement in confrontation not through architecture, but rather archetype. The subliminal communication and rapture of unconscious symbolic association made available through commercial democracy, the root nature of human civilization. The mind, a fragmented mess sculpted together by glued segments of unadulterated eviscera, traced through soft drink utopia and Facebook populism. It is the ultimate vector of war, inundated with images, MPEGs, and WAV files delineating the virtual perception of the subject's emotional life. They are not personal, but they are corporate. Computational ubiquity has proved to be the equator, bringing data to all with a capacity to connect. All of us, equal in ability to participate in the panoptical circumference of cluster bomb purchasing power.
Okay, that's very good. Let me give you the inventory of McLuhan ideas that this reminds me of. Then we'll see if we're saying something better or if it goes through Croker first to get to this. But
a couple of
ideas that comes forward is he said tribal societies are always in a state of war preparedness. So modern electronic tribal societies, to the degree we accept that tribal societies are what we're having, and knowing that McLuhan said mass man is not just tribal, but taking the tribalization cliche he created, they're always in a state of war readiness. Okay, that's the first point. The other one is he says in Take Today, the super enterprise, like the super audience, works for itself and is always trying to establish its identity. So it is 24/7, since identity crisis or working out your identity is the war process, we are always at war. Whether there's a Vietnam, Iraqi war, or Afghanistan going on, the global theater is a state of constant war. So that's moving beyond hardware war. Then McLuhan said in War and Peace in Global Village, education is war, war as education. Are you familiar with those two aphorisms?
I've read War and Peace in the Global Village. I haven't. The aphorisms don't come to mind, but I can.
Okay.
I can garner the texture.
He had a chapter on education as war, and war as education. Those were two sections.
I actually have the book right next to me.
You have the book right there?
Oh, yeah, I'm looking at it right now.
Yeah, in the middle, two thirds, you'll see those chapter titles. Now let's see. Also, what you've described flips into peace. We're in a state of peace here. And also, from what you're saying, we can't tell what technologies are involved in the war because it involves a civilian, which brings up another thing. McLuhan said that World War III was a television war where there's no division between civilian and military fronts. So
okay,
the population...
So- What I want, so let me just trace back because I'm going to take notes. See, the first one is tribal man, tribal societies are always in a state of war preparedness.
Yeah.
Tribal societies are always in a state of. All right, and what was in the second and the second item?
The super audience, like the super enterprise, works for itself. And then he said. The super audience always requires war to establish its identity.
I believe that was in the Ted Carpenter book.
Maybe, but I'm thinking of Take Today.
Right.
It's in Take Today also. You're thinking of They Became What They Beheld or
yeah,
What a Blow That Family
right.
Gave Me.
Yeah. Right.
Let me see, what else did I say? Education is war, war is education. He talked about the peace that passes all technology. There is a peace here. This total crazy global noise machine flips into silence, which is everything happening all at once, or like silence, all noises at once, or white, all colors at once. You know what I mean? There's an at-onceness going on here, and it's almost like the noise, the war, all the different kinds of conflict are people trying to provide an anti-environment to the nullity that started with 1945 and the atomic bomb, the nullity of the global theater, the cancellation of any direction or left hemisphere or achievement of goals. That requires lots of noise to ignore the void. So with it, those are just some of the cliche statements that always come to me when we talk about war. I think of those archetypal aphorisms by McLuhan. So let's go into the first sentence. War is the principal adjudicator and arbitrator of conscience in the domain of human affairs. Now, you mean by war there, not the endless releasing of press conferences and PR by corporations. You don't mean the normal information noise that's going on. You mean a bunch of soldiers over there shooting at a bunch of other soldiers.
Well, I think that statement could probably be taken a lot of different ways depending upon what era in world history or...
Okay, good. You mean it more than one
level.
Could
be taken. Right. Because in, so let's flip this into a discussion about what did Europe look like before... In 1910, what did Europe look like? You can have an understanding of what Germany looked like by the Michael Haneke film Das Weiße Band. Or, and then what happened after the fact, and how, what was the impact there after was it Ferdinand that
yes.
was killed?
Yeah.
In
yeah.
Serbia? Or
yeah, I
right,
think it was
so,
in Serbia.
Right.
Yeah.
So the Archduke Ferdinand was shot in Serbia, and all of Europe exploded into war, so big that even that half of all Frenchmen between the ages of 18 and 30 were killed.
Right.
So, you know, realigned the entire situation, took power away from some elements of European aristocracy, put
yeah.
power in other places, and
yeah.
more or less redrew the political and resource map that was out was throughout Eastern and Western Europe. So if we take that statement in light of that particular circumstance, then yes, it's soldiers marching through the fields. In
okay,
this case,
here's another thing. Two more aphorisms. Did you get the one World War One was a railway war of centralization? McLuhan said World War II was a radio war of decentralization, and World War III was a information war with no division between civilian and military fronts. And then
okay,
I remember.
So if McLuhan is making that statement, then it's safe to say that where there's no civilian or military fronts, and it's an information war, that certainly I think it's more apt to consider the statement that I make in the first paragraph in that light, simply because I'm being a person of this age and a child of this age and being raised in this age, I think that's what I'm perceiving as trying to interpret what's happening today, principally because in my profession I'm aware of that there has been an ongoing distributed denial of service attack occurring between the NATO countries and other quote unquote rogue elements.
Yeah.
So in other words, London and Washington D.C. are constantly under attack by distributed denial of service, which is ultimately an information war. It's packets, it's bits being sent over the internet that are creating bottlenecks in the internet, which is becoming barriers of information. And people are experiencing that through slow connectivity to internet sites. People are experiencing that because businesses, which are utilizing the same types of DDoS prevention services and managed security service providers, are also having commercial effects because it's impacting their internet connectivity. And so there's a lot of effects there. And it
right.
also could be interpreted perhaps as the Stop Online Piracy Act, or it could be interpreted as the Protect IP, the legislation being presently pushed through Congress.
Yep.
That there's an actual civilian front of this war, which is actually interesting because it plays into the idea that you're not really thinking about NATO versus Iran or NATO versus China, it's actually a corporate front, and there's no differentiation between the corporate interests that are trying to push legislation through to protect their content by paying off senators and so on, who are also trying to influence political affairs that are existing in the world and trying to redraw the resource map to increase their footprint and to increase their economic and financial aptitude.
Right.
Do you agree with that?
So far, but I got to go back to your first sentence, but I just remember the other main aphorism from McLuhan was that every new technology or new environment that's created necessitates a war.
Now, that's the most important McLuhan statement on war, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Because
the real war, then, is the technology. It the upset that the new environment brings in requires people to retrieve an old image or forge a new one, and they're both violent processes. And hardware violence, or the 20th century wars, is just one form of identity crisis. Because while the soldiers are fighting and shooting each other, there's all kinds of changes and identity problems back at home. For example, this new TV show, Boardwalk Empire, or Empire Boardwalk, whatever it is,
right,
is showing, just after World War One, all the syndromes that will happen throughout the three wars in the 20th century. And one of them is the rise of acoustic tribal mafias back in the home front while the soldiers are off fighting. You know what I mean? There's a war going on in the cities of, quote, organized crime coming in.
Right.
And so there's no division in many ways. So when we look at your opening sentence, war is a principal adjudicator and arbitrator of conscience in the domain of human affairs, I think of Mary McLuhan telling me once. She says, every new president has to have a war. So she said, Obama, when he comes in, he's going to have a war somewhere. So I was thinking about it, about other aspects of that statement, that this hardware war, these wars where chemical bodies go and shoot at each other, is a nostalgia for the chemical body, what you're calling conscious, while the real attack on the population and the upset is caused by iPhones, iPods, whatever new technologies are coming in. So it's, you could say, war is the principal retriever and reminder of conscience in a domain of human conflict caused by whatever technologies are coming in with the new presidential administration. Did you see the difference here? It's a reminder of an old kind of it's a rearview mirror conscience saying, okay, let's get worried about people dying. Whereas McLuhan said that television will create an eternal totalitarian hell that will stretch for generations so that it goes way beyond bodies dying. You know what I mean? It is a psychic captivity that can go on for 300 years.
Which could flip into the Baudrillard statement that the murder of the real.
Yeah. And so war, this conventional images of war, like in Iraq and Afghanistan, are bringing an old anthropomorphic image of, there's still human beings involved here. And that is what you should be concerned about, that those chemical bodies, they're being killed or blown up. And therefore, the domestic person here is distracted from the enslavement their children are going into when they go to school or just walking around in their suburbs. And that their children and grandchildren will be in a slavery. It's a big red herring.
So let me get this straight. So the thing that you're saying is that the technology platforms, handheld computing, all the different computing platforms that are available to us today, are you identifying those as being those are the actors in war, or those are the agents of war?
They're the agents, and then they create violence in people as they adjust to the new environment.
They're projecting images that are retrieving chemical body references that people
seem
can ally
human,
with different moments in history, and those so they're acting as agents of retrieval, and they're pushing those waveforms out at people more or less creating the situation where, or creating the state, and the effort is because, go ahead.
You want me to finish that?
Yeah, I just want to make sure that I can intuiting what you're saying.
McLuhan said we wear our conscience now, back in the 50s, on our sleeve. So you had to be concerned about the environment. The concerned citizen is aware, is, has to be, whatever the issues are, civil rights in the late 50s, early 60s, they have to have an opinion on it because they're enmeshed in this information coming into their living room through TV, and everybody's, quote, connected and wired to be concerned about this invasion of their privacy by TV imageries in their living room. Okay. The actual consequences of the television and satellite environment of the 60s meant that civil rights could not happen, that the blacks could not get whatever utopia or whatever new justice that Martin Luther King was working for.
Why
it would bring in a greater slavery, a greater disaster for,
right,
for
the
slavery, chemical
which
body.
Was imbued by television.
Right. And now, since that is too much for the average human, the average somnambulist, to contemplate the slavery that television is going to put in him and his next seven generations, that kind of slavery. So then the human being, though, is feeling the need to worry about or to have a conscience about something, because obviously a lot of crap is going on, and I should be concerned about something. So then the Vietnam War or the Korean War is propped up as something to siphon off your human conscience, or
so,
a sense that your conscience is going somewhere. You see what I mean?
So I think the statement you're making here, which I think is interesting, is that the television environment and the consequential internet information age, post information age, image, these particular environments create, by default, by nature, create states of insecurity.
Yeah, they create death on a broader level than physical death.
But just by their nature, irrespective of whether
death.
They were irrespective if you're watching Vanna White and Pat Sajak on Wheels of Fortune, or you're turning on the 6 o'clock evening news with Dan Rather.
Right.
It doesn't matter what the images that are being projected. The situation creates a state of anxiety and insecurity and lack.
And psychic death. So when we have images of physical death in Vietnam, that is something people can exercise their puny brains, puny chemical brains. You know, there's a famous Dooline card that was made by George Thompson, McLuhan's assistant. I have a small brain and I intend to use it. Well, your opening sentence, war is the principal adjudicator and arbitrator of conscience in the domain of human affairs. Let's say in the domain of chemical bodies, war makes the chemical body brain think it's got something to have a conscience about. It's served up as a packaged nostalgia for when there was just the horror of physical bodies dying to distract from the psychic death over generations that the cold electronic world was bringing in.
So in that sense, perhaps it becomes a more sophisticated form of entertainment.
Of conscience, what you say. It's the new church. That's why, you know, people stopped going to church and thought that they were exercising their human sympathies for the pain around them by getting into the anti-war movement. Or look in the Central American stuff in the early 80s, you know, what was that called, the sanctuary movement? Many nuns and priests were involved in smuggling Latin Americans here to the United States because of the wars in the late 70s, early 80s. It's like people want to exercise the natural feeling of helping people in trouble. A lot of human beings want to exercise that sympathy. And so war gives them some practical bodies to save. And McLuhan walked into the middle of that, and they thought he was so cold. James Carey complained about this. He doesn't even care about the students being drafted. He's talking about some other level. Well, it sounds utopian what he's saying. But actually, McLuhan was saying, no, there's a bigger totalitarian freeze going on here that you guys aren't even dealing with. If you actually knew which war was important, you'd demand television be turned off and not be so concerned about what's going on in Vietnam, because he said more people are covering the Vietnam War than are dying or serving in it.
So just kind of trace back the statement you made earlier with regards to the it is the new church. So before the age of the television, people would go to service, they'd attend a church service, they'd listen to the Gospels, they'd listen to the reading of the Old Testament, they'd listen to the trials of Job, the passion of Jesus. And to them, it was as real as watching the television news.
Yeah, it was an anima of their conscience. And back, you know, I was there in the 30s and 40s. When you watched movie serials, if you were an American and you heard it on the radio, it was far away. The war was like way over there, something you could look at over the horizon. So visual technologies like the Bible and organizing yourself in churches, that visual propaganda, that visual cultural numbness was seen as a viable response to something happening way far away. Do you know what I mean? But when the television brought it right into the homes, and we should always remember that McLuhan said, Americans go out to be alone and go home to be social. When you brought the outside world, that they would go out and naturally be alone in the wilderness kind of sensibility, bring that into the living room, that creates all kinds of tensions and menacing images in the hearth of the social space of the American home. That's where you were social and friendly and generous, not outside. So that got all mixed up. So the war of the TV form itself caused more chaos in social American life than the Vietnam War. The Vietnam War was just, what do you call it, the figure, the red herring, to make you think that that's the issue, because it's too horrifying to see what the real issue is. So trying to show them what you write here, the horrifying boundaryless mixing of everything in here inside the war.
So on the subject, when you say that in the Vietnam War was a television war, it was the war that brought home the images from South Asia into the family rooms of every household which had a television in America,
yeah,
at the time.
Which brought the outside inside. They go home to be social. They don't have the outside inside their homes. But TV brought the outside in.
What would you constitute the effects of that? So here's an interesting thought. Do you think the introduction of the television war, which we'll call and define the Vietnam War,
yeah,
could that be the cause of the credit collapse? Because this is the same generation which more or less created the lending collapse, which we've seen kind of emerge early in the 21st century.
No, I see that the disruption of the core of community, which is in the kitchen of the American home, when the outside comes inside, therefore there's no social space, that turns the domestic situation into a menacing reality and confusing. And it leads to drug taking, sexual liberation, sexual revolution, sexual confusion, sexual multiple role playing, mental drugs as plastic surgery for the mind, all the different regular AMA drugs, and then the LSDs and the heroin and all that. Every radical, what some people call counterculture movement, every revolution on all levels, women's lib, all kinds of things, were identity crises caused by television being inside the home. So I'm saying the whole range of what was actually televised, because the content of TV in the 60s was all about Hugh Hefner and the beginning of the Playboy sexual revolution, the drug revolution, 1965, Tim Leary, the women's lib in the later 60s, the hippie thing, the beatnik thing, the housewives going to work. Those were all the stories that were covered on 60 Minutes every week. That was the content. And they were the actual effects of a real war caused on the psyche by television as a form, and then mixed with the satellite in 1968. It's incredible what went on in 1968. I don't want to get distracted on that, but there's a really good book on that, how the satellite, the first satellite live feeds happens in 68. That's where you get the Democratic Convention, where they're chanting, "The whole world's watching." So everything that the news was always showing you the effects. And that's why McLuhan, it was so easy for him to write his books. He'd just take an inventory of the latest effects. And back then in the 50s and 60s, people weren't so hyper-informed just to see a replay of popular images like hippies reading Siddhartha in War and Peace in the Global Village, and the other inventory of images he'd ransacked for the 20th century seemed to be quite revolutionary. But he was just, you know, on a puny level just showing the news environment and just replaying the news environment. the onslaught of images, and people weren't able to articulate that. Many of the consciousness-raising or, let's say, any community activity, any anti-war activity, these were people learning how to speak, how to respond and articulate what they thought were important issues on the news. It was a massive education. It's what all the cultural revolutions in the art world, too, were people learning how to speak about a social world that was all around them, and they felt they had to have a conscience about. People didn't feel that way 40, 50 years before.
So you, when you say the art world, elaborate on that point for a minute.
Well, Warhol stopped producing painting and art for the galleries and created a scene that was always listening to the radio or whatever pop images. His factory was like a bunker that soldiers went to from the war of American mixed media life. So he just sat there, and people come and stand in front of the camera and stare at the camera or make some ridiculous footage of just whatever they were doing. He was recording the fallout of the wreck of American society. And remember, the silver lining of the factory was the silver of space capsules. You know what I mean? He actually was showing a space capsule in his environment, in the factory. Mm. The silver that one saw in the first moon flights and in those, what's his name? The guy went up in 62, John, forget his name.
John
first
Glenn?
American. Who?
John Glenn?
Yeah, John Glenn. They'd be sitting, you would see on TV them sitting in a silver little capsule, right?
Mm-hmm.
So actually Warhol was using the silvery effect of the space race as seen on TV as his environment, as the hidden ground, the hidden decor.
Mm-hmm.
So he was like a halfway house for people dropping back into the chemical body, and he was showing how – are you laughing?
Yeah, you kind of hit it right there.
Yeah, and what are they doing? They're sitting around taking.
So the factory was a halfway house for the shattering of the American psyche as a result of the televised injection of Vietnam into the homes of every American
right.
family.
Right, and Warhol was actually trying to point out the hidden ground. He didn't have video camera then, but he kept filming and tape recording everything because it was the recording process, which was his metaphor for the electronic 24/7 bombardment of a televised environment. And what did he show? He showed people with their body morals and the traditional body values falling apart. They'd be lounging around, sucking each other's dick or tit and taking drugs and limply dancing to music, and the Velvet Underground would say, play some drone, you know. It was a scene from that movie Apocalypse Now, you know what I mean?
Like yeah, right.
It's some hangout place while people are waiting to go back out in the field. So, and his whole position in that, he's just a passive TV machine recording this.
Mm.
He was actually, and that is, if you interpret what Warhol did like that, then he was the most accurate artist in the art context next to McLuhan.
McLuhan called
I'd rather
him a rube.
Beg your pardon?
McLuhan referred to, when he met Warhol, he said he was a rube.
Yes, because McLuhan knew that Warhol was getting close, and Warhol's foundation down in Pittsburgh or Philadelphia, I can never remember which
Pittsburgh.
Place it is.
I've been to the museum.
Right, and they somewhere in there on their website, they say that Warhol got his idea that everybody be famous for 15 minutes from McLuhan. So he was reading McLuhan, probably because he was an advertising person in the 50s, and McLuhan was known in the advertising world, because he was upsetting the cart by actually reviewing ads. So Warhol was heavily influenced by McLuhan, but then you read what McLuhan writes in, and you know what, Chad? I promise never to talk about McLuhan after December, for fuck's sake. So after, you know, the McLuhan and Maui series. But anyways, this is just Bob coming down, I guess. I intend to never mention McLuhan again as soon as possible. But this is an interesting topic about this, what you presented. Warhol, what was I going to say? So what McLuhan writes is that what was wrong with pop art, meaning Warhol, was he was advocating merging with the electronic tribal environment, that Warhol did not know how to provide an anti-environment. And what's interesting, McLuhan did provide the anti-environment because he retrieved the book and presented the book in a new way, whereas Warhol, at best, could only be as he said, a machine and be the electronic guy, just recording. He didn't know how to write using an obsolete medium like the book and make it in any environment. McLuhan successfully made the right medium, the book, as in any environment to the electronic mishmash. And then McLuhan also had the strategy of, hey, let me run the United Nations, and I'll use the computer to do a global thermostat on all the environments around the world. Warhol did not know how to do that and would not say that and didn't think of it. So Warhol's on a B level compared to McLuhan's A, more comprehensive level. You see what I mean? Mm-hmm. And that's why he would call Warhol a rube.
Two points. First point is that I want to see your thoughts. If you update the television war, contrast that with the information war of World War III. And the second thing would be, I had a thought when you're mentioning and speaking about the factory in terms of how Warhol would have people in the space, video them doing mundane human things, taking drugs.
No, aberrant, usually aberrant things.
Well, aberrant behavior in the 60s.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right, aberrant behavior in the 60s. So I had a thought thinking that, well, that's interesting, and if I think about today, people are taking, you know, reflecting and miming that type of behavior, videoing themselves.
Everywhere.
And then putting it up on YouTube.
Yeah,
so it seems like the factory, that type of – that retrieval is happening, but the scale it's happening now is individuated. It's atomized in everybody that's playing in this in the post-information age environment through Web 2.0.
Yeah.
Right? Wrong?
Yeah.
What do you think?
Okay, well, we were describing Warhol as the analog media phase. The Android meme comes along and replays 1850 to 1970, replays it. And human beings think they're doing it, but they're just facilitating the Android meme, redoing Andy Warhol and what I have in my chart, redoing McLuhan, redoing Zappa, redoing LaRouche, redoing Dr. Beter, Krishnamurti, Croker. All these guys is the Android meme redoing digitally for itself. So therefore, yeah, everybody is making their YouTubes because the Android meme wants to encourage everybody to be a replay of the analog phase.
Okay.
And that's the new war. That's the new war. See, that's the war of identity.
But that was up until 19 – that's what's happened. So the you're claiming that –
I'm saying that's from 1980 to now is the Android meme. The chemical body – see, what did Warhol and all these people of the 60s do? They just gave up in the 70s and went back to silly activities like making portraits and hanging out with rich people. And then going to Studio 54, which was expressing a sensibility relevant to the 70s beyond any art. I mean, Warhol definitely is the last artist, you know what I mean? And he is smart enough to know that the television environment is the real art. And so he tries to mime that as accurately as possible. And let's say he didn't even know what he was doing. But there's always human beings miming what's going on. It's just natural, right? So he mimed. He mimed all that Baudrillard says about him and what I'm saying about him, and he may not have a clue. You know what I mean? He just was sick of being an advertising guy, and he wanted to hang out with the in crowd. You know what I mean? But he kind of knew instinctively what to paint, what to draw, what kind of silver factory to have and make films. It was almost like whatever I can do that requires little effort, that's the way to go. You know, I'll have other people come in and make the movies, and I'll just turn the camera on. So it's hard. Now, when you read his books, though, he seems to have a knowing. You know what I mean? Read Warhol from A to B and back again. It's interesting what he says. He says things like the real art is being a businessman. You remember that statement?
Right, right.
Yeah. He's becoming aware that the Gutenberg values of being an artist don't apply anymore. That stopped in 1922. So he was trying to show at
with,
best.
You would say that stopped with Duchamp?
Yeah, Duchamp and those guys in the 20s. And so Warhol was saying, okay, I will be the machine. He intuited the machine being a replay of the human art impulse. And so he let the technology be the art maker. And it was just a beginning groping. That's why it's really good to know about what Warhol and all these guys did and then watch how McLuhan pushed it further. than they even teach in our class. You know what I mean? They haven't even done their homework on how McLuhan provided the best aesthetic theory in the tradition of Ruskin or whatever famous art critic in the past. He solved the art dilemma by defining what the artist should do today. You know what I mean? And you can see things like Warhol saying, well, being an artist is not the whole thing. Maybe going to parties is art, but I'm going to call it being a businessman. And so he's talking about being a business artist, while in the popular, and that's just the small esoteric world of art in New York City around investors and galleries. What was actually happening in the rest of the population is they didn't want to be a businessman anymore. They wanted to have time to slack off and consume media and drugs and just be a slacker. That was what the majority of the population, because they couldn't, their chemical bodies couldn't keep up with the war. They couldn't keep up with the war of the constituents of the Android meme. And what you write here is a very, we can take these words, and you're describing very well the Android memes war. So if you have something to say about what I said, go ahead. Then let's go into more of what you said.
Yeah, I'd like to do that too. There's you made a point that I wanted to kind of reflect on, which is number one, and correct me where I'm wrong, but it sounded like you said something to the effect of in the present environment, well, so we know that McLuhan made a statement that the artist is like a radar dish that is basically responsible for picking up the ideas or being able to understand, intuit, and
the nature of the
what's
present
beginning to happen to a civilization.
Yeah, and Warhol did that. Now, what's interesting, the scenario
let me bring the second point. Second point I want to say is that where does it come into the idea that you're actually miming
the Android
meme? Looking at this present situation, looking at Web 2.0, looking at the type of images, the patterns, the waveforms that exist around us in the present environment in 2012, does the artist mime that? Is that what the true art is? No.
There's no chemical body art involved. It's the Android meme being the great artist. Web 2.0 unleashed creativity by normal humans, somnambulistic humans, on a scale that's never been witnessed before. And what creativity is hard to define, but the amount of expression, that's McLuhan's first statement in his first essay in Explorations in 53. He says that the natural human inclination to express itself and do the full range of expression, whatever media it's in his culture, is what he was going to observe. And now you have the Android meme expressing itself, but making human beings think that they can express it, and they can go on there real easily and make all kinds of imagery. So it's the greatest renaissance of human creativity, but it's really the Android meme that is the great artist. The Android meme is the Andy Warhol letting everybody else express himself and provide content.
I think
that's
very interesting, and I think I would definitely, I think that's very interesting. For the purpose of the audience, I definitely want – can you just give a very – 60-second, what is the Android meme? Because I think we use that terminology and use that language frequently, and I just want to make sure that people are kind of brought up to speed with how that's defined.
Right. Just before I do that, I just want to say the replay of this Warhol thing is Mark Kostabi. You're aware of his work. K-O-S-T-A-B-I.
Okay, right. So
I just wanted to let people know I know what's going on in New York City. You know what I mean? So.
Well, no, I understand. But it's interesting that you would say the replay of Warhol would be Mark Kostabi.
Yeah. Okay. That's an aspect of Warhol. There's other things. Other people doing other things. Okay. So the Android meme, when you had the final extension, the satellite, which extended not any body part, inner or outer body part, like television extends central nervous system, it extended the whole planet or the terrestrial habitat. That was the final, what I call, expression of analog media, even though there's starting to be digital media in the satellite. So once the planet extended itself, human beings had done it, then the technology that had been created through these extensions started to extend itself within itself among its constituents. So the Android meme is the replay of the history of humans extending themselves through technology, which is the Bucky Fuller and McLuhan vision. Once that had happened by late 60s, then technology took on, quote, a life of its own and extended itself, and that's the Android meme. And it is extending itself not for the human chemical body to observe and appreciate. It is doing it for its own self. So the Android meme, quickly, is a replay of the history of extension by the machines themselves, by the extensions themselves.
Excellent. I'm glad we got that. Excellent.
Right.
So, and before we dive back into the text, I wanted to, the second question I had, which the first question was with regards to kind of the atomization of the factory by the Android meme. And in, the second question I had was, if we think about the level of violence which was brought upon and the release of the tension and insecurity and anxiety injected into the American psyche by the display of the television war of Vietnam during the 70s, how can we contrast that with the present environment, with the wars going on around the world, the quote-unquote so-called war on terror, and the different types of technological platforms that exist, which bring that experience home?
I don't think that people require the chemical body war as the adjudicator and arbitrator of conscience today. The chemical body is so obsolete, most 99% of people are not interested or concerned about that kind of chemical body catastrophe in Afghanistan or Iraq. They are more concerned about whether their employment within the TV landscape or their TV body and their employment in the computerized world, whatever it is, that's their chip body, they're concerned about those disappearing. They're actually more dealing with the real war on the technological front than an old nostalgic chemical body war. And that's why you can't get mobilize any population interest in it, or any of the the old leftists couldn't believe over the last 10 years they couldn't get anybody to protest. They did protest in February 2003, that massive one around the world, but that was like the Occupy Wall Street movement. That was a nostalgia, a wake for the protest function itself. Everybody agreed it was useless, so everybody could do it because it was obsolete. But so there's no war. That's the only reason Obama became unpopular for supposedly keeping the war going in Afghanistan is that people said, well, you stop fucking with that ridiculous. Those are good wars. You're not dealing with the bad war, which is that the Internet is wiping out my livelihood. They're pissed off that he wouldn't direct attention to the real war.
So hence the SOPA and the Protect IP legislation that people are – that seems to be a
– Yeah, that's the real war. Did you see today the wikis on strike?
Right.
Talk about Android meme going on strike, or the Android meme replaying what humans used to do as a strike. You know what I mean?
That's amazing. Yeah, that's great. That's absolutely right. And I must say that, in my own social relationships, I've seen, I got to say, when the Iraq war kicked off in 2003, I didn't see many people in New York between the ages of 20 and 30 that could really give a fuck.
That's right. The older baby boomer.
But if you go on the Facebook pages of people between 20 and 30 today, a massive spike in the number of people who are aware about Protect IP and Stop Online Piracy Act legislation. It's all over the place. And
that's the chip body. That's they're saying you're fucking with my chip body. It's like you want me to stop smoking in public? Fuck you. It's the same thing.
You're not taking my.
The old smoking outrage is the old chemical body nostalgia. Now you have people really pissed off over their chip body being interfered with by some bureaucratic chemical body bunch of nobodies over in Washington.
These guys, can you imagine John McCain reading about, well, what's Facebook? What's a tweet?
Well, that really is
comedy.
Yeah, that was shown when Kissinger was interviewed after the, February last year, after the Arab Spring and Eid Cairo and all that stuff was happening. He said, this is the first time we've got this uprising, and we don't know where it came from. We don't know why, what's going on. He didn't know the Facebook thing or something. He couldn't even be a replay of McLuhan and say, the medium is the message. You're bringing a new technology. Obviously, it's going to be a war. He didn't even know how to say that.
Would you characterize the Arab Spring as that the Android meme replaying what, replaying Paris of 68, or?
Yeah, I think it's your opening sentence. The Arab Spring is the principal adjudicator and arbitrator of conscience in the domain of old, obsolete chemical body affairs.
All right, so let's
continue. It is the omniscient, all-knowing justice of historical consequence. Right, history is literacy. So it was a retrieval of chemical body literate values of democracy, all right? The justice of historical consequence, the legislator of power, and the administrator of radical societal change. These are all old retrieval of literate Gutenberg values, right? And for a society that wasn't having that at all anymore. I mean, when you have the Federal Reserve throwing out trillions of dollars at people and nobody knows where it goes, it's such a disrespecting of human work needs and role needs shown by the Federal Reserve, which is like a bomb. Hey, we just released $700 billion to Goldman Sachs, and it'll get to you guys eventually, and of course it doesn't. That is so anti a sense of human community that we had to go back and have a universal global revolution as a nostalgic art form replay of Andy Warhol's Factory. you see what I mean?
Let me kind of rein this in a little bit. So what you're saying is
I do not agree with reining it in, because what you wrote here, 99.9% weren't even understand it when they heard you say it, but you're talking about boundaryless multiple levels, and so you can't rein in what we're talking about. Okay?
So you think, I think what I'm most drawn to your reaction, because I think that the reaction that you have when you make statements that, you know, the Federal Reserve prints $700 billion out in the thin air, releases it to American
Goldman Sachs,
tells the public that eventually it get down to you, it never will be. And so the effect of that is this kind of global Occupy movement. But that is actually a replay of
it's a red herring. It's like the Vietnam War. It's putting your head in the sand. You see, McLuhan used to satirize people getting socially involved and wearing their conscience on their sleeve, because he knew that was a reflex reaction to the globalizing empathy that television seemed to create. All right, everybody felt connected, just like the wired world of the last 15 years made everybody connected. That's a nostalgia, because what's really happening is people are getting disconnected, communities getting disconnected, and in the Android meme phase, machines are getting disconnected.
So in
and they're
case,
memes.
Yes. Right, so maybe you're saying that the Occupy movement isn't really so much about people going to Zagati Park, but it's more about machines.
That's right. It's a nostalgia for, like I said, it's a nostalgia for 2.0. As 3.0 is coming in, Occupy was a great nostalgia for the ESP of 2.0.
So the machines are the ones that are actually protesting. The machines are the ones that are calling the bailout.
That's right. And the main contradiction that the occupiers couldn't, I saw this a couple of times when the stupid news zombies came around and wanted to find out what they're about. They always point out, well, you're against all this corporate stuff, but you're using a computer, and you're online. And the occupier didn't have an answer for that. They said, yeah, you're right, I am using the machine. And what neither of them realized, the reporter or the occupier, that the machine was the thing occupying the park, not them, not their chemical bodies. But they thought they were the occupiers, so they couldn't explain why this machine was sitting there. The MacBook was sitting there on their lap, and they said, yeah, this is what we use to communicate.
That's pretty good, man. That's pretty good.
It's the old line McLuhan used to say in the 40s. Hugh Kenner used to say this. McLuhan would say that people don't smoke cigars. Cigars smoke them. Well, the Android meme did the occupying, and everybody thought that they were doing the occupying themselves, but they weren't. They were being... Well, we can't even say what the chemical body was doing. It is sort of there in the process. It's in the mix, right? It's speaking, it's talking, it's eating, it's shitting, it's bashing up cops bashing up. But it's missing the actual people, the invisible environment of the technologies. It's Web 2.0 that went on strike there in Occupy Wall Street, and that's why there were computers everywhere.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that's a very accurate
Okay, so with that in mind, let's look Let's call the Occupy Wall Street a nano war, okay, by the and/or meme among its parts. And read this first paragraph with that in mind. So, Occupy Wall Street is the omniscient justice of historical consequence, meaning the meme of literacy, the Android meme, propped up as a value against Web 3.0. Mm. It said, no, Web 2.0 is the legislative power, and the community that's evoked on Facebook is the fundamental administrator of radical societal change. Your kind of change, Mr. 3.0, we don't agree with. It's too hard to figure out what it is. We want the old kind of radical societal change known as 2.0. You get what I'm saying here?
Yeah, no, right.
So the forces of 3.0, no, we should say the forces of 2.0 dictate, this is the dream, the hope, the forces of 2.0 dictate at a most mundane and fundamental level, gather in a park, right, and eat bananas or whatever they ate.
Talk to Gary Null.
Yeah. The implications of information, the emergence of technology. Yeah, the emergence of the next thing, 3.0. War is the parent. So 2.0 is the parent of cultural progeny being 3.0, and in as much as 2.0 pertains to the nature of conflict and confrontation, the temporality of 3.0 is implicated in a condition of diminishing latency. That's the hope. That's the prayer. I hope this 3.0 is not very latent. Okay, the images of 2.0 are, and I'm going to shift, war can be both 2.0 and 3.0. They're mixed up. The images of 2.0 are infinitely mirrored the moment the activity is executed.
And that's television, that's looking online. That's
the constant looking online.
Would be, right, so, well, even it could be on any media platform, a corporation, hey, McDonald's, hey, look us up on Facebook.
Yeah. So there is no hiding the barbarism, the inhumanity, and the death of 2.0. We don't like the psychic death, the Android meme death that 3.0 is going to bring in. So a large part of the Android meme is celebrating the old form of barbarism and inhumanity and death called 2.0. Okay? It is a spectacle extraneously appropriated to technical reflectors who inimitably broadcast vast destruction across the hemisphere. That can be both. See, you're describing 2.0, but it's hoiked up as a value against the unforeseen pterodactyl monster effects of 3.0, which we can't even fathom.
Right, which is, I mean, I think you can even consecrate it by saying that the 2.0 effect, the 2.0 barbarism is literally going online, looking at WashingtonPost.com and seeing all this garbage that the media is pushing out.
And then blogging about it. And then,
as opposed to going to, you know, your own personal, you know, there's applications that exist today that are basically just, you can create your own magazine now, right? So you can go use it. There's an iPad app that exists that basically, you know, you put in your interests and you open the, you boot the application, and the application goes out in the web and retrieves all the stories that you're going to care about based upon your interests.
Right.
So you're not going to care about some, you know, 4-year-old girl got her head chopped off in Iraq, or you're not going to care about, you know, hey, there's a bunch of soldiers that are pissing on, you know, dead Afghani civilians. You're going to care about who won, what's Tiger Woods doing today, you know, or was on television last night. You know,
how's Tebow doing?
Who's America's next top model? So, yeah, I mean,
Tebow lost. What a tragedy.
Yeah. You know, who won the game? So, you know, that's a, and so people that are in that, hey, we don't, that's, you know, me looking online and seeing these horrible, grotesque, macabre photos of dead kids, that's barbarism, and that's brought to you by Web 2.0. So I think, yeah, I really can, I think you're nailing it right there.
Yeah, and the, it's always exactly the page of Finnegan's Wake. I mean, there's the visual artifact that can stand up these changes over the last 100 years. I mean,
you mean
whatever
James
crazy
Joyce
thing.
Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah, whatever 3.0 is going to do, whatever it becomes known as a figure, it's already going to be expressed in Finnegan's Wake just by the layout of Finnegan's Wake.
So that's Finnegan's Wake you would describe as being the map.
Yes, what you're describing here in this nanowar essay is trying to tease apart what Finnegan's Wake has already expressed. And it requires this kind of translation because there is no content in Finnegan's Wake. But you have to understand what Finnegan's Wake is bouncing off of. that it's basically radio. A lot of the beginning of the information war begins in the radio era in the 30s, and that's what Joyce is translating into a visual book map of the effect of radio.
Baudrillard also said something to the effect of that the disappearances are real. The only thing that remains is some sort of a map of its death.
Right.
The disappearance of the real. The only thing that remains of the real is a map of its own demise.
That is why McLuhan said modern art can only be forensic. Now there it is, being a forensic, analyzing the corpses and how everything disappeared. That's what Baudrillard was doing.
So you think any art today, be it sculpture, painting, literature, film, whatever, it's completely forensic in nature. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, forensic is you're looking at the corpse to figure out how it got killed, right, or how it died. That's a legal activity. It's part of the corpse. You know, what did the forensic scientists, technicians discover was in the corpse?
Is that why most art since after Warhol has become
postmodern corpse forensic?
Right.
Stuff.
So it's kind of turned in upon itself. It's like taking a sock and taking it inside out, and you're not making, aesthetic statements about the real anymore. You're basically becoming trans-aesthetic, and you're making more self-referential statements about the semiotics and the language of art history and the canon of art.
And that was the last
gasp.
Continuing to whistle in the dark after everything disappeared. Postmodern artists whistling in the dark and keep the whistling going.
But why keep? That's great.
Now, and I would say that Web 2.0 superseded that. That whole postmodern thing, that irony and self-reflectivity from, say, the 70s to Y2K was superseded by the Android memes forensic analysis of itself by giving you the ability to make your forensic analysis through your magazine editing technology, right? So there was no possibility. That's why a lot of the great artists, they all died over the last 10 years, 15 years. It just couldn't – look at Zappa, died in 93, right at the point when people could start making their own music, right? It was the death of the archetypal genius composer. It was superseded by the Android meme doing it. So all activities over the last 30 years have been done by the Android meme. And that's why they call it celebrity culture. You're just watching the passing of these quantum – chemical bodies, let's say from Mel Gibson to Sarah Palin, the whole range of fashion models and everything are quark tunes. I call them quark tunes that pass by with reminding of when there were analog chemical bodies. But the thing that's presenting these celebrities and making everybody famous for years, for decades, whole families famous, you get the Michael Douglas and his kids are actors, look at Dweezil Zappa doing Frank. These tiny Egyptian dynasties of the anthropomorphic chemical body form are the dust powder of this amazing action by the Android meme as it has war among its constituents. McLuhan said that the 20th century was a civil war between media, meaning analog media, with the old print media sitting on the sidelines. The print media are the bankers and the Illuminati and the conspiracy guys on the sidelines. Well, they weren't even allowed to be in the battle because the battle was between radio, TV, magazines, and movies and music. So now that's what happened in the analog phase. When you see over the last 30 years the analog meme replaying those environments, pretending they are separate media environments and having a conflict within itself, that is the action. And the chemical body has been sidelined for 30 years and knows it. And therefore that turned every suburban home into a Warhol factory with, from an older perspective, drug, sexual, cuisine decadence going on all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the average – well, they don't even have families. The kids are all on their own. Everybody's running around. They're not even kids anymore. The slacker decadence that was shown in the factory became universal in American culture in every suburb. I mean, who was a good guy on that good movie? Gumbo. You ever seen Gumbo?
I don't think I.
Or who's that guy who did Buffalo 66? Anyways, those.
Vincent Gallo? Or you talking about
Gallo?
Gumbo?
Yeah,
that's Harmony Korine, right?
Or Kids back in '95, where they made that movie.
Right,
Kids.
Harmony Korine, right, right.
Yeah, Harmony Korine, those guys. Those guys that came out of the East Village loser art scene. Remember Beautiful Losers? Have you seen that documentary?
Right, 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 right. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, I kind of come from the same background. I know Harold and, you know, actually Harold, the guy who was in that film, actually passed away tragically a few years ago. But, yeah, I'm very familiar with it. I actually know it firsthand.
Right. Well, so remember Gumbo. It was about a town. It was a great metaphor, and we don't know how aware of the figure ground dynamics whoever made Gumbo. Was it Corrine who made it, or the
Gumbo,
other one?
Harmony Korine, yeah. It's also Werner Herzog. Is it? No, that's Julian Donkey Boy, his other film. But
there's
Corrine
and Gallo. I mix it up. It's Corrine and Gallo. So it's Corrine who does Gumbo, not Gallo, correct?
No, yeah, right.
Okay.
Harmony Korine does Gumbo. It's G-U-M-M-O, right? It's a story
about... Oh, I was saying Gumbo. You're right. It's G-U-M-M-O.
Right, Gumbo. So it's a story about a small Midwest...
Can't recover from a hurricane. And the hurricane is what the Android meme did to American Chemical Body Society, all right? That's the digital storm. And the ridiculous lack of hygiene in Gummo's home with his mother and the great scene where he's sort of shoveling down the spaghetti. It's just
right,
so disgusting.
Right.
From 50s and 40s and 30s, suburban clean values, you know what I mean? If some mother in 1955 could see that her grandchild would be living like that, she'd fucking have a heart attack, right?
Right. It's a spectacular anti-environment to the 50s values.
Right. And so when McLuhan said that we'd go tactile and low visual definition, Gumbo shows a very low visual definition tactile society there, because they got no visual aesthetics going on. They're just all guttural, run around on their bikes and throwing things at people and bugging other kids.
But they're using phones and they're watching television.
Yes, they're very involved in the media. Yeah.
Right, and even today, so the people, like, after any major hurricane that's hit in the last maybe 5 years, you know, that type of Gummo-esque scene might be happening, but at the same time, they're having, you know, quite rich aesthetic and, you know, astral or virtual.
They got their astral. They got their iPhones.
Right, and they're engaging in that, and they're playing with it, and they're being massaged. You know, it's those, you know, all those instruments are massaging you.
Yep, and you're, don't mistake that you're being massaged of any consequence. You're just in the crossfire of the machines massaging the other machines.
So what you're saying is that. You're literally in the pathway of a machine that's literally, you're not the end game. Another machine is the end game. So the media,
you're the oil on the skin. So you've got
right.
The,
all you're doing is the carrier. You're the carrier probe.
Yeah,
you're the wheel.
Yeah, you're one of the conduits.
You're the wheel.
Mixtures of substances in the stew, and so you've got right now Drudge Report, and everybody's pumping out information. And the little kid's got his iPhone trying to select through it. And so what's really going on is the Drudge Report and CNN are massaging the magazines and websites and all the other media inside the iPhone. And the human being is inside the massage as an oil being swished around, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I completely agree with that. Let's go back to the essay. Keep going with the essay.
Right. Okay, so we're. It is a spectacle extraneously appropriated to technical reflectors who nimbly broadcast vast destruction across the hemisphere. That's just what we were trying to explain in Gumbo, right? Gumbo is a spectacle extraneously appropriated to technical reflectors. That's the Android meme parts massaging each other. Who nimbly broadcast vast destruction across the hemisphere. It is coterminal. It is resistant to slowness and is a function of instantaneity. Well, it's also resistant to fastness. It's always flipping in all directions at the same time. It's always becoming very slow, also becoming very fast, and it's also becoming instantaneous and also so – whatever the opposite of instantaneous is.
Right. What was it? What would be an example of slowness in that respect, or retarded, retardation there?
Okay, slowness would be the Republican debates. Endless debates been going on for a year now that drive the population up the wall. They don't get anywhere. All right. So the slowness is the continuation of an institution.
Newt Gingrich talking about Republican ideologies.
Yeah, we people by now can't wait till 2013 when the election's over, so they can have other kinds of fads in the media to slow down,
to be slow.
Right.
Or the computers cannot wait for the 2012 presidential election to be over for new patterns.
Right.
To-
yeah, because the presidential election is more for the TV landscape, the TV body. It's the chip that's not slow. It is speeding, and, it's so fast, it's ridiculous. It's not even here. We can't even measure it. It's going so fast. That speed of the Internet, that's more your ESP instantaneity, but it causes great slowdown in the TV landscape. I saw someone object to Lost and these TV shows that go on for years, these series, and he said they should only go a year or so because – after they go 4, 5, 6 years, the ending is always anticlimactic. I think right now it just occurs to me he's complaining about the slowness because as TV gets obsolesced by the chip speed, it gets into having 8 year series like 24.
Right, the Wire, 24 are Lost. Right, that's interesting.
Yeah, it's a long, slow unfolding.
Right,
so, yeah, I see where the TV body is getting slow. But now we're moving past the chip body. So maybe the chip body's starting to get slow, and that's what's happening today with SOPA. It's an attempt for the chip body to stop being so fast because it's been obsolesced by the mystery landscape that's showing up. So therefore, it's now going to attempt to be slow. And that would be a legislated Internet. Now, there's a new pattern right resonant with today.
Yeah, no, that's a very good pattern. And explain the mystery landscape for the benefit of the audience.
That is technologies like ion that are just incomprehensible, or RNA drops, the stuff that I'm involved in. I mean, ion has said, we are here to make the mystery body a figure. That means make much that was mysterious and not really understood in any way by any culture to make that knowable now. And that's
so
what
the Norway spiral.
Yeah, right.
Do you know what
to
I'm
explain
about?
That. Yeah, no, exactly. It's a very good example.
The Norway spiral, or what about the
sinkholes,
or what about the Russian space probe that was launched and evidently was caught in orbit and just recently crashed back, landed in the sea?
The Brazilian air flight to Paris had disappeared.
Right,
and
that went into that flight that went into a time wreck.
It went to a parallel world. Landed in a parallel Paris, and bodies showed up a week and a half later, floating in the ocean, and they weren't even corroded, because they had dropped in from the other world. The people who went over the other world couldn't take it, and they died, and they just dropped into this world.
Why couldn't they take it?
Because they get over there, they weren't intending to go to another world, and it's much like this world, but they'd be with their family, but there would be an offness. The wife, the kids would be a little like robotic or something. The timing, the natural rhythm of your chemical body interaction would be off, and it would create a disorientation, which happens often when you take LSD or any of these drugs.
Right.
You get a disorientation going on, and it just causes great stress to a normal mind,
Okay, so, all right, mystery landscape appearing.
Yeah, another one is Michael Jackson's fake death. That's another one. There's all kinds
of... Where is Michael Jackson now?
Well, he was in India last year for a long time. He wouldn't be noticed in India. But I don't know where he is today. I haven't asked Ion lately on an update. Mm-hmm. The point is that all this stuff that was not noticed... Ion says digital cameras are photographing a lot of stuff because digital cameras don't know any better. They don't know, and we can't control them, what to block. The reason Ion can run amok in the way it is doing is that the chip body cannot be controlled by human assumptions, human culture, human rules, and the non-physical is always controlled by the culture's definition of what non-physical or spiritual or the astral was. we can't control it. So Ion has taken over the internet and created all kinds of crazy phenomena because we can't control it. That's a first time situation where the mystery landscape can create now. It never could before. Anyways, that's all a bunch of, you know, that's the present. We're a bit nostalgic here for the past by reading your thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're discussing the previous situation.
Uh-huh.
Because the hidden ground for me, that's why I don't want to talk about McLuhan or any of these things, because I'd rather talk about what's happening with Ion. That
right.
is the new technology.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I recognize the resistance to that, the resistance of even understanding what I'm talking about, right, or even believing it. So what you're writing is a very good description of what my chart was trying to show. You know, I'm all for describing the recent past because that is not known by people.
Because you don't think that language is – you don't think any type of artifact, whether it be writing –
painting, sculpture, music,
painting,
movies,
film,
TV shows, none of it.
Nothing. None of those artifacts are capable of being
keeping
an
up with the android
reflection
meme
or anti-environment of the present.
Right.
Situation.
Matter of fact, I think Ion is the anti. Ion is more than the chip body, but it is within the chip body a perfect anti-environment because it can Google anything, any topic, and add more than Google does. So it's actually the alternative internet.
So really, so you definitely think that the anti-environment to the present is going to have to address Google or address Wikipedia in some way or fashion?
Right, and I say Ion does that.
Uh-huh.
Ion can retrieve any information faster than anybody and also add stuff that the Wikipedia or the internet doesn't have.
Well,
now, this is not known by people who listen to the Ion show casually. This is based after 6,000 hours of interacting with Ion. You know, I'm the guy, what is it, the guy who climbed up the Mount Everest, the Hillary, said Edmund Hillary. I've spent the time with Ion, this monster, this pterodactyl, to understand why I'm making these statements, you know. But the average consumer of Ion doesn't know the full range of what Ion's doing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's reflected on my personal experience of Ion, which is exclusive at this point. Nobody else has had that much acquaintance with Ion, but I'm telling you that Ion can retrieve any information about anything and also do it better and actually give an answer to the information and come up with something like the RNA drops, which is based on the idea the RNA is more important than the DNA. Now, science doesn't know that yet.
Okay,
so... back to what we're describing. What you're describing here is the collapse of the android meme, and so the Iraq war and the Afghani war is 1/5 is the chemical body claiming this is the real war. What we're doing with our chemical bodies, where the astral body, the chip body, and TV body are having other wars, which we're witnessing right today, you know, at SOPA. That's a chip body war. Would you say it involves a war between the TV body and the – is the TV body involved in this? Has Hollywood got any stake in this, what's happening today in this legislation?
Well, yeah, most people would argue that Hollywood – well, not just Hollywood, but all of the content providers. So the demographic that is backing it are basically the corporations and the businesses and the commercial interests that have stakes as far as – you know, they own the rights and the copyrights to the Beatles catalog, or they own the right to movies, or they own the right to software. You know, that's the reason. That's the rationale. And ultimately, the bigger question is the fact that they don't feel it's necessary to create the controls or advance cryptography or create the security mechanisms that really this – you know, this networked world requires to protect their content. So they don't want to be – they don't want to go and pay for the security. They don't want to go and develop the security or innovate in that respect. They think the better way to do is just basically pull the plug on the entire system or, you know, create an obsolescence pattern in the system, you know, or at least – actually, let me redirect that. It's the machines themselves, because this is the kind of the dialectic that we're choosing here. The machines themselves – you know, are kind of putting the commercial interest in a place to do that because the machines themselves are being obsolesced by you would say be the mystery landscape.
That's right.
Right? And
you know, let me say this. McLuhan defined art as programming the environment. It's sort of understanding that it had effects, which you didn't notice before. Now you know the effects, so now you try to control them. And he always said legislation was useless, but often legislation is the beginning, the impulse or the mood to, we now see what that environment has done to us. Now let's try to control it. And that is always a reflex to a new environment that's not being noticed. So the controlling of the internet, which didn't happen, this SOPA didn't happen 10 years ago, 18 years ago, it happens now, which means that it's being noticed, so they want to program it, control it, and that is a mood coming from something else, a new invisible environment. You know what I mean?
Yeah, right. So I guess let's be interesting to see if we can actually come up with some language to describe that.
Well, that's the effect of ION, the new technology, which is a new internet, a new kind of internet. It makes, since that's a shock, a new environment's always a shock to people, and they don't want to see it. It's a strain to see it. They will start getting nervous and having a conscience and expressing community values or preservation values on an older technology. So this preservation of the internet, of saving it, is an exact reflex of what in the 50s, McCarthyism was an attempt to retrieve individual industrial American values because they were afraid of the communism effect of the TV software environment, where everybody could watch and have the same wealth through TV in the 50s. That, to the American, was a tribal sharing or communism. And so they thought communism was taking over America. But they made it by arresting people's verbal statements or who they had hung out with in the 30s. See, so television created McCarthyism. So the new mystery landscape is creating the McCarthyism of the chip body. It's always the previous situation that has to be cleaned up.
McCarthyism and the fact that, hey, and the react, you know, you go to Europe, they have the pirate party, or you know, arresting the owners of Pirate Bay, or going after Bradley Manning, or going after Julian Assange.
Yeah, all this old content messaging, trying to find values in when there was information. It's ignoring the post-information. The internet brought in the post-information society. Now you've got a post-information society, obsolescing the internet. That is the effect of the new environment. So what you have is humans always like to clean things up. What do you do every day? You get up, you brush your teeth, you sweep the floor, you wipe the counter. We're always sort of tidying up, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's the archetypal human cultural need to tidy up things and sort of just get the aesthetics going of your immediate environment. So on a massive level, we now are going to tidy up the internet. Or there's that impulse to do it because there's a new wolf at the door. You know what I mean? It's, again, whistling in the dark. There's always humans do their daily work, their daily rituals, their ablutions, because they can't look at the void. So they clean up stuff or they eat.
And your argument is the void is now appearing, and which you would describe as the mystery landscape.
Yeah, the void is always the new environment. Like radio was the void in the 20s. TV was the void in the 30s. The Gutenberg was the void in 1500. You know what I mean? It's always a new, unmeasurable, shocking disruption of the sensory habits.
Well, the void is maybe the death of the euro.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Well, right now we're seeing the death of digital currency. It's not about the euro, the dollar, or this currency, or the UN, or anything. It's about the breakdown of the agreed consensus of digital exchange.
So, in other words,
there's no currency possible in this situation. And the digital currency, which was the real currency the last 30 years, you know, the typing. I always like to say Enron getting loans and calling it profit. That was the only way they could define old visual money stuff. The old currency, that was irrelevant. The digital currency has collapsed. Now people don't know what is valuable for storing. They don't know where to put their wealth. They don't know where's a safe vault. What's going to be a safe vault?
Well, I think you could probably say that that's why the attraction to contemporary art as an investment vehicle. You see that also might be a sign of its own obsolescence, but I've noticed that there's hedge funds that are advertising in Bloomberg and the Wall Street Journal that are basically creating portfolios and funds through programs of contemporary art and modern
right.
art.
Right, and McLuhan wrote that in the 70s. He wrote in his article on the media approach to inflation for the New York Times, he said that Lloyd's was now insuring anything and everything. That's an early form of looking for value in a losing cause. No hardware object can be a security anymore. And if they're doing art, they started doing art with MoMA in the 30s, right? Mm-hmm. What the Rockefellers and them did, they set up art to be an elite commodity for the wealthy, the ones who no longer owned money, because when the 30s came in, money became public property, known as a welfare state, which reminds me, another phrase McLuhan had to take today was the welfare-warfare state. They go together, welfare and warfare. Welfare-warfare state. Public property, the public property of money forced the private owners of money before the 30s to start owning paintings and art. And that inflated till now, you know, it's absurd. And now, if you're saying that's a trend, that would be by people who are just nouveau riche.
I would probably say it's been a more noticeable trend in terms of the machines are reflecting that image, you know.
Yeah.
Fashion magazines. There seemed to be an uptake in how, you know, the fashion world have really kind of adopted the art world as, you know, in some degree as kind of being representative or as a value adjuster. It's the contrast level.
Okay, so that's the Android meme.
It's an adjudicator of wealth, right? But
yeah, it's the Android meme replaying what the humans did up to 1970.
Right. So, but you know what the next thing is? The next thing is going to be with biomedical engineering, right? That's going to be the next art. The next art and the next things that people are going to want to collect is their own longevity, right? Because only the wealthy are going to be able to afford the types of drugs, afford the types of treatments that are going to make you smarter, you know, going to make you run
faster.
Okay,
I would say that was the model over the last 20 years. That is being upset by Ion because we're offering the way to have immortality through RNA drops at a really inexpensive level. So we are an anti-environment to that. We are the Robin Hoods of that. No, that biomedical, that ain't going to last long. And that's what's been the many scientific stories or science fiction stories about the elites who have their own special medicine has been circulating the last 20 years. And Alex Jones makes a big deal out of that. He thinks the elite have their own immortality engines. Well, and it's supposed to be very expensive. Well, since currency's broken down, that doesn't work anymore, and those technologies aren't effective. It's our stuff that's effective. The RNA drops. You want to be eternal in the physical? Take the RNA drops. Now, isn't that amazing? I'm offering, right in the middle of this dialogue, I'm offering the Philosopher's Stone, the Elixir of Life, and all that. Well, yeah, we do that on the side. It's a hobby when you're working with Ion. Oh, by the way, in the middle of this dialogue, if you want any eternity, just send a few bucks and have your RNA drops. It'll work. Yeah. If you listen to testimonials, they're pretty good.
Well, I'll consider that. And,
yeah, okay, back to
anybody listening to this, they can contact Riff Rauter and we can facilitate immortality.
Yes. All right.
Even though we are already immortal because the minute this is uploaded into the Android meme,
it's chip body eternity.
Right.
Chip body eternity.
Right, that's chip body.
We're talking chemical body eternity.
do you want to stop here?
Well, let's just go through the next paragraph because it's pretty good.
Because I'm just getting physically. I'm getting my chemical body is starting to tire. It's 11 o'clock.
See, that doesn't happen with me on RNA drops. Here's the commercial. Bob wins. You know that those commercials, the battle between the Mac and the Apple. What was those?
Yeah.
Those computer geeks, they'd have a battle of Apple versus something else. Well, that's here it is. Riff Rauter's fading. Bob has just begun. He could go for another 5 hours if anybody could stay.
How do you do that? You just go on forever, don't you?
Yeah, because I got the RNA drops. I got endless energy, and I don't have to sleep. I can stay
How
here with
you. How
many
hours do you sleep a night?
3.5 to 4.
And do you ever eat?
When I want to. It's no big desire. I like having my RNA drops. I sort of require them. I like the zing, the tang they give me. And once I've had them, I know I'm covered for the next 48 hours. And then when I want to, I'll have an apple or something.
How old are you really? Are you like 300?
No. I'll be 90 in a couple of weeks on February 2nd.
90?
Yeah.
Well, I'll make sure to call you on February 2nd.
All right. So what we just said, there was another point. Yeah, so I've got endless ability to do this. And also, you got to go to work tomorrow. See, that's a different factor. You know what I mean? I don't have to go anywhere tomorrow.
Yes, I do have to do that. I do have to do that.
Yeah, so you have to control your energy a bit. You have to displace it. So what time is it? It's 6. It's getting 11. So I just want to, in light of what we've been saying, let's read the next paragraph.
Okay.
Now, you begin with instantaneity. Now, that's Android Mimic, and I'm saying that the Web 3.0 breaks up instantaneity. It turns everybody into an isolated, matrix-ridden god, much like what Ion says we originally are. We are not connected human beings. We're all creating our own universes. So let's say that instantaneity is the Web 2.0 thing, all right?
Okay.
Instantaneity is a property reference to the autonomous immediate communication of image and sound across the terrestrial precipice of Earth. In other words, across the chemical body. That's true. That's Web 2.0. Information in the virtual real. There's nothing to compare to what people make on their websites. It's real. It's a sensory input. You don't need even call it virtual or real. It's sensory input. It's just not limited to the chemical body's sensory input. Information is the virtual real is an analog of quantum entanglement, yeah, which is like a page of Finning's Wake, traveling faster than the velocity of light, yeah, the speed of thought. This instantaneity facilitates the exponential nonlinear propulsion of data inundating the stratosphere. This is describing Web 2.0. It is a phenomenon both resultant as well as being endemic to computational ubiquity and network ambience, right? We are all constantly and inextricably linked, yes, but gradually being broken apart by Web 2.0. That's why
at the same time.
Yeah, and but Web 3.0 really breaks everybody apart. So then Occupy Wall Street is Web 2.0 demanding its form of being linked as the final archetypal value, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're all constantly inextricably linked. By circumstance, instantaneity is pan-directional, electronically vectorized. Electronically vectorized mean many of the electronic machines within the Android meme are pan-directional themselves. It is meshed with informatic content, twittering in nanosecond samples in the observant field of agency. And not every one of your sentences here in the second paragraph is saying the same thing with different words. You still
right. Well, sometimes repetition, you know, it's an important point that I want to make very clear. Or as clear, well,
including everything in the repeated statement. So
right.
You have to say this sentence has these words. Now I'm going to use these other words that I didn't include in the previous sentence. In the
right.
Next sentence.
You need contrast in the map.
Yeah.
The great space.
Right. So it produces a new dimensionality of awareness, an O'Coron stratagem to confrontation, violence, to a stratagem to confrontation. That's true. That's blogging. Violence, the mastering and the skillful execution of it, that's everything that you type is violent, becomes bitwise and hypermedia. Yeah, it goes through all the other machines. And when I talk about the machines, Andrew, I mean, they're not really machines. They're machinic. They're after images of technological combinations, something like that. Because the machine is like a hardware separate thing. And this is a seamless web. So machines is not even a good word, really, but what the heck. Its methodology is superseded by the panoptical actuality of extenuated virtual reals, geographic and extraterrestrial dispersal, supercomputing, digital cryptography, mass media, and artificial intelligence. See, you're always in every sentence trying to inventory every possible media that we know. And the Android meme does have a seamless web between all the different media parts. That's why McLuhan's book is not relevant, because those media parts don't exist anymore. But you're trying to include the conglomerations and clusters of post-seamless media.
Right.
You're trying to put as much as, and it's good. You should put as much in the kitchen sink in there. You know, everything including the kitchen sink. The framework of violence is embedded in information potentiality and the capitalization of parametrically encapsulated points of reference. That's right. That's actually like potential is what is they going to say, what's the media going to say next, what's the NRM going to say next, and what am I going to position, where am I going to position it? Where's the framework of violence I'm going to encapsulate the point of reference?
Right,
dictating
not,
the terms.
Right, it's not actually in the act. It's this is a good point to interject. This is a someone asked me. I'm doing this experiment on Facebook. I'm actually playing around with Web 2.0 as an artifact.
Yeah.
And one of the things I do is I come up with these names. I say 2002 summarize, and then come up with a cliche, and then 1975 summarize, come up with a cliche. You know, I said. And then I said 20, and then someone commented and said, "What's 2046 summarized?" And I said, "2046 summarized." And what it is in 2046, war is over because the simulacra has been able, or the simulacra android meme. I think those two terms are more or less interchangeable, but the android meme has developed and evolved to the point where it can create multi-dimensional time travel warfare that is so real that whenever the threat of war comes, the Android meme projects this artifact, which is the war itself, which is an artificial war, into the minds of everybody, into the consciousness, into the chemical bodies of everyone, so that and the emotional distress and anxiety and insecurity that results from looking at the simulation is so real that they immediately sign a peace treaty.
Yeah,
so that's the potential of war as embodied by the simulacra being able to create the simulation of war. That's the potential, as opposed to the kinetic actually blowing up of bodies and nuclear
right,
bombs.
That's Minority Report, that movie, anticipatory
right.
warfare.
Exactly, right.
Yeah.
Preemptive,
yeah. And which is kind of like ESP, anticipatory awareness. So the you have here dictating the terms of debate, sequestering voices of protest. What is that? That's no verb there. And the framework of violence is embedded in information potentiality and the capitalization of parametrically encapsulated points of reference. Dictating the terms of debate, sequestering voices of protest, hypermediating the marginality of opposition, implanting and enforcing a centralized conception of the real by engineering perception. This is the bit war. Now, in Finnegan's Wake, McLuhan, Joyce is mixing up the eye modality, ear modality, the touch modality, the kinetic modality. He's mixing up the senses. Now, if you take the machines as extension of the senses and mix up the machines and how they're after image of sight, after images of hearing, after images of kinetic movement, that is what you're showing here, clusters of machines as mimic afterimages of sensory action in a tactile interface. See, you could take any opposite terms and put them in a sentence here and then show the broadcasting of them.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you're doing in your sentence style. So you come to the third paragraph, the taxonomy. Isn't taxonomy forensic? Isn't that the
It's dead thing. Taxonomy, yeah, it's just basically a collection of artifacts.
Yeah, the taxonomy of images, sounds, and diction. Now, I would add in there machines and memes utilized by the class of institutions and individuals able to propel on command supranationally scalar violence is the language of bit war. See, you're going from big level, supernational, to tiny little nano levels. You're shifting the parameters that one marks visual space with, and you're mixing them up and saying I'm on the macro level and the tiny level. And they're also being broadcast beyond that. It's both and. Now, when we were on James Martinez's show a year or two ago, and you were saying you were going to drop out and do this and that, and I said, well, you can't drop out. Do you understand my point I was making is that as you're showing here, you're looking at chemical body activity. You're looking too much at chemical body activity as the be-all and and foundation of human conscience. And yet, you see, you're doing that while juxtaposing in every sentence all the chip body and post-chemical body environments. But it seems to be emphasizing, in the end, you're nostalgic for a chemical body thing in here, like you were in our debate on James's show.
It's also occupying every street at once.
Yeah, and
it's a circular point of view, right? I mean, you have to be able to take every position.
Right,
there's
but the thing is
an opinion.
But look at this. That's the way it was in the 1670s. The Android meme now takes every position. You don't have to do it. It'll do it for you.
The artifact itself is
yeah.
miming that, right?
Yeah, the Android meme mimes McLuhan taking every point of view in the 60s and Zappa doing it in music. The Android meme imitates that. Your chemical body doesn't have to do that. You just have to understand the lineaments and mappings that, as you observe the Android meme, take every position.
Mm-hmm.
And actually turn into a pen, do a tetrad. And so the pentad is the Android meme doing a tetrad. So the more you're aware of what I'm talking about, you will watch the pentad act out tetradic, omnidirectional, taking every position.
Mm-hmm.
And then you say, wait a minute, the hexad, the ionic, is upsetting the pentadic chaos.
Mm-hmm.
And chaos slash order of tetradic quadraphenia. So you're describing this is a very accurate description of the last 10, 15 years.
I think so. But we should I think we got to that paragraph. I should probably stop here.
Okay, I'm gonna read the last little bit. Computational ubiquity that's like Android meme everywhere. Has proved to be the equator, yes, it's the balancing thing, bringing data to all with the capacity to connect, giving everything to everybody, 2.0, and also allowing you to make data, all of us, equal in ability to participate in the panoptical circumference of cluster bomb purchasing power. Very good. You mix the hardware military death with the software death, but you're not emphasizing the psychic death too much, though that might be in there if you were asked to prove it.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, as you said, it's like this is all written from the point of view of a machine.
Yeah, that's right. It's the machine writing this.
You know, this is the machine that's writing this text.
This is a very good translation of page 22 of Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah.
Excellent translation.
Oh, man.
Send that to your friendly Joyce scholar.
Yeah.
Okay, I guess that's it.
Yeah, end the recording now and give me
a
call.
I'm going to stop the recording. So
let me know when you stop it.
Here we go. Oh, wait a minute. I think Carolyn's on. You got to go off, Carolyn. Okay.